shepherdess@harmonyfarms, where we encourage you to think big, start small, and don't quit. Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Shepherdess Podcast. And this is part one of a dynamic interview with market farmer Luke Gross of Gross Family Farms. He is successfully farming on 20 acres of owned land. He is a first generation meat farmer located right outside of Louisville, Kentucky. That is his primary market. He has been at it for 11 years, and the podcast upcoming outlines his journey from zero to where he is today. As always, today's episode is sponsored by Farm on the Web, which is my program where I teach farmers how to be marketers. In this course, we cover things like how to build your own website, how to manage social media channels to generate a profit on your farm, how to use newsletters to connect with your audience, and more. We are taking enrollments probably middle of this month. I'm going to open it up again for our next enrollment cycle, guys. So head over to farmontheweb.com, put your email address in, and I will notify you when we are ready to go. Thank you so much, and enjoy the episode. Okay, so can you just give us an overview of Gross Family Farms as it stands this very day?
Sure. So as of right now, we raise 6 species on a given year of livestock on pasture. We raise pork, chicken, beef, turkey, duck. We raise and sell meat direct to consumer in the Louisville, Kentucky area. And we sell first and foremost to a meat CSA. And we have about 150 members or so in that program. And then we have a number of restaurants, grocery stores, buying clubs. We sell wholesale too, and kind of our third market stream is a small farmers market that we use and we go to once a week, and it's year round, and we use it as a drop site for CSA and for also chefs who want to pick up there too. So that's what we raise and how we sell it and who we sell it to.
When did you start? When was this all founded?
My wife, Catherine, and I started farming. This is our 11th year farming on our own. On our 5th year, we started raising pigs in addition to vegetables, which was our main deal. And then 2 years later, we realized that we loved raising animals so much, so we're just going to cut out all the crops and do exclusively animal for meat. Now we're in our 5th or 6th year doing all animals.
Did you initially set out to make this a full-time, or did you expect it to be sort of part-time supplementary thing? If I'm right, it is your full-time deal right now.
Yeah, so we haven't had any off-farm income for, I guess, it's been about 5 years. And it always was the goal from pretty much from the beginning. We thought we wanted to make it that, and that's what we were trying to do when we were raising vegetables. We always had some form of off-farm income for those first 5 or 6 years. Since we've lived on this property and been raising animals exclusively, we've pretty much been full-time with no off-farm income.
So what acreage are you working on right now?
So we own a 20-acre farm here in southern Indiana, and we have kind of beg and contract out and borrow land across the neighborhood. Right now we've got about another 30 or 40 acres where we have some grazing rights this summer, and then we have another farm where we have another farmer who contract raises some of our chickens for us on his pasture, and they start a life out in our brooder and then they move out to his pasture. So he raises every other batch of chickens on his land, so we have access to his land, and he kind of works under our label, and all the chickens we maintain ownership of. So it's a collaborative arrangement that's kind of different from renting ground, but it works out really well for both of us. And it's one of the ways we've been able to kind of bat outside of our 20 acres.
You are basically making this your full time on 20 acres of owned land, and then 30, 40
That's right.
of beg, borrowed, hopefully not stolen land. I actually did not understand about your farm that you are working on sort of that micro acreage, and then you worked creatively to find the other resources you needed.
Yeah, we did rent another 12 or 15 acres of pasture 1 year, and we came back to just our 20, and then we started that relationship, and then this year we got that extra grazing ground. And we're looking to maybe buy some adjacent property to us. But yeah, the 20 acres definitely feels tight, especially since we want to increase our grazing ruminants, which before we were doing sheep, and now we kind of moved to doing exclusively cattle in that department. We'd like to have more ground, and we're thankful to have what we do have right now.
Yeah, Dean, I'm going to ask more questions on that in a minute. But to backtrack a little bit, so you started 11 years ago, and for 5 years, you've had no off-farm income. What was sort of the evolution? You started with vegetables. How did it go from there to a profitability level that could sustain yourself and your family?
Well, you know, I have friends who do vegetables and do it profitably and do it well. And there's a number of kind of channels or paths that can work. And we were kind of in a unprofitable lane, I'll say. There's some of the folks who are doing kind of the micro farming and micro acreage with high value crops that are out there these days. And a lot of those people, they kind of started farming during or after the time we started farming. John Martens and those guys who all wrote books in the last decade. And so we didn't really have some of those examples. And so it was kind of tough road to hoe. I'll say that in addition to kind of me being really green and not very good at business and more idealistic than business savvy. So between those things and not knowing what we were doing and not having good models to go off of. And, you know, the kind of farming we were doing was basically like a team sport. We're trying to do it by ourselves, and it just really wasn't working out very good. It's a short way of putting that 6 years we were raising vegetables. Then I started kind of getting into some of the possibilities ecologically with raising animals on land and how they, you know, essentially they're doing a lot of the weed management and harvesting for you of the forages on the ground. So I like the idea of that ecologically, and I could imagine a world in which that could make sense economically. And, you know, got into some Joel Salatin YouTube videos and books and kind of continue to move forward with a vision for what our farm of the future could look like. We had twins after our fourth year of farming, I think it was. And I was sitting there like taking one of my wife's overnight feedings, and I was holding two bottles of breast milk in my right hand. And there was a twin in each, like the crook of each knee. And I was like watching YouTube videos about how to raise pigs in the woods and just trying to figure out how I was going to be able to like spend time with these children someday and also be a farmer, because I was kind of realizing that I needed to be able to be producing more profit per hour of time invested. It wasn't really working out for somebody who all of a sudden had three kids under two and wanted to spend part of his life with those children. So the animals kind of came in as I had an ecological curiosity and a realization that this farm business wasn't going to work out if we didn't figure out some massive change. So we started with the pigs. We did like 20 the first year and 40 the next. And then we got our own property that we live on now. And that's when we kind of brought in all the other animals and just started doubling down on what was working through and through. And we got a little flock of a dozen ewes and a ram. And we just got more pigs. We got started with chickens and first year on this property, which I guess was 5 years ago. We were just kind of starting a bunch of things and seeing what worked. Later on, we brought in ducks and cattle. We raised the sheep flock until we had about 55 head. And then we kind of started dropping that down as we added more cattle. We cut out most of the vegetables. We just had like garlic and winter squash for a couple of years. And then we decided to just keep on cutting what's not working and fitting the bottom line and our life's goals and just how we want our life to work and do more of what is working. That's kind of how we set where we are today.
Well, that's interesting. In that first year, when you went from vegetables to moving 20 or 40 pigs in your first year, what were your main sales streams there?
We actually had massively increased the size of our vegetable garden on those first two pig years. And we were kind of doubling down on that while adding in the pigs. And that's really the first time where we really were kind of making not all the money we needed to live off of, but we were realizing that the pigs were almost as profitable as 5 acres of vegetables and way less work. But we had a lot of restaurants we already worked with, and we had farmers markets at that time, more than one. And we also had a veg CSA. So we were just kind of marketing that meat out throughout the year off of a couple fall harvests to the folks that we are already selling to. So we just kind of started turning that current customer base over into the new product, basically.
That makes a lot of sense. So even though you didn't realize a huge profit in those first 5 years, it basically paved the way with a customer base, and you were able to run with it a little bit faster because you had that initial customer base.
That's definitely true. Yeah.
So what was behind your desire to farm, your first generation?
I think it was a few things. When I was a kid, I kind of grew up in my dad's garden, and he was an agricultural missionary in East Africa who married the daughter of an agricultural missionary in East Africa. And he had a couple agricultural degrees. And I was always kind of curious about just things that happen out in agricultural settings, especially with animals. And you know, my dad would kind of talk about them as we drive down the interstate, but he also hadn't worked in that world for quite some time when I was in my childhood. But it was something that kind of was in the water some. But then on top of that, we had a really big garden growing up. And then my wife, who we started the farm pretty much right after we got married. We did 1 year of working on another guy's farm, and then we started the farm ourselves. But she also had a dad with a really big garden, and kind of always, we just really loved being in the garden with her dad, and a lot of great memories from that. So we just did some gardening and had some chickens when we first got married. And then we really didn't care much for our careers, where they were at in our, you know, early mid 20s. And, you know, it's kind of like a mid 20s career crisis. I didn't really like this, and why not try to do something that I want to do? And around the time we got married, I met a farmer who, she was in a veg CSAF, and she was volunteering on his farm. And more or less, he needed someone with a pickup truck to run a farmer's market for him and do some harvest work. So I worked for him for a year. But I also tell the story sometimes of when I was in sixth grade, I always thought agriculture, growing plants. I had some rabbits. These things are really cool. And I love the idea of them. But my sixth grade teacher, which sixth grade for me was like 1992, kind of fresh off the major 80s farm crisis. And my sixth grade social studies teacher, who was really willing to speak his mind about anything, said, there's no such thing as a small farm anymore. Everybody got bigger, got out pretty much last decade. I thought, oh, okay, well, that thing that I thought would be a good idea, I guess that's not a thing anymore. So maybe we'll try something different. And then it was until I met the CSA veg farmer that I kind of thought of that as being like a thing that people do. And then once I met him, we kind of just started a farm that sort of looked like his. That's kind of how Catherine and I got into this, more or less.
When I initially found out about you, it was the CSA element of your business that really caught my attention. And could you explain what that is to somebody who basically has no idea what we're talking about?
Sure. Yeah, a lot of folks are more familiar with the vegetable CSA. And what that looks like usually is during a growing season, there'll be oftentimes like 6 months or 5 months worth of vegetables once a week. You get kind of whatever comes off the farm. This is sort of model off of that, but it's all meat from our farm. We'll give you between 3 and 4 species of meat in a given month. Usually there's pork, chicken, and beef in there at least. Essentially, once a month, you get a bundle of meat that's farmer selective. It's based off of what we think would make a really good mix for a family that month, but also what we just kind of happen to have in our inventory at the time. We have 3 different sizes, and we have home delivery in the Louisville, Kentucky area in 4 counties. You can also pick up at one of our drop sites. We have 3 different locations. Like I said, 3 different sizes. So you can, you know, there's one, the smallest one's $75 a month. You get about, it's 10 or 11 pounds of meat. And then there's like a 16 or so pound version and like a 24 pound version. And of course, if it's steak month, it's going to be less weight than if it's drumsticks month. But more or less, you know, we that's sort of an average, but it varies depending on what's in the shares.
So CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture. And it's kind of, to maybe somebody who doesn't know about it, it would be defined as like a subscription, if I'm right.
Yeah. And we kind of struggle about whether to use that term. People who kind of buy direct from farmers are oftentimes, but not always, familiar with it. It's a meat of the month subscription program. I mean, there's different kind of ways you can kind of pitch it out there to people. And yeah, we kind of try to not get hung up on the name, but really try to sort of make sure people understand what we're offering. Once they kind of get used to it and realize that, they realize, you know, meal planning is no longer a big problem for me. Instead of what am I going to make this week, I just look at what I got this month in the freezer, and I got all my meal planning taken care of. I know I'm going to have spaghetti at least once, and we'll have steak night, we'll have wing night, et cetera, et cetera. And they can kind of work off of that. We're trying to meet people at where they want to be, with convenience and, of course, quality, but also just kind of the possibility of making their lives easier in a few ways. You know, we have to meet people where they're at, and there's just a bunch of American parents trying to feed their family.
On average, what is your CSA customer sign on for? 3 month term, 5 month term?
Yeah, we'll let someone do a 1 month trial if they want to. 6 month commitment is kind of what we ask people to get started with. And just this year, in order to kind of help with attrition, but also just kind of be more customer friendly, after 6 months, they can either do another 6 months upfront, paid upfront, or they can sign up for like monthly billing. Mm-hmm. So I just tell people, if you want to switch over from like your annual Reader's Digest subscription to like just Netflix, where we take it off your credit card, We'll do that. And we'll just do a 21st century subscription program. We got most of our folks on that monthly billing program, which isn't as good for us on cash flow, but I think it keeps the turnover a little bit lower, which is good for us.
Because then when you go back around for that 6 month bill, that's a bit of a difficult thing to swallow.
For sure. I mean, our mid-sized package is $100 a month. So it'd say, hey, it's time to write the $600 check. Or if you prefer, punch your credit card numbers in on this Square website, and then we'll just bill you $100 a month, and then you'll be good to go. So people are really liking that. And it's nice for us. We don't like wring our hands hoping they sign back up again. They're just in the program, and it works out good.
That sounds like an ideal situation. For $100 a month, roughly, how much are you able to pack into that for your customers?
The short version of how we structure it is our retail farmers market prices are kind of set here. And then for $100 a month, you get 20% more than you would if you're shopping at the farmers market. So you get like 120 retail value. And then we'll change that up and put different stuff in there depending on sort of like what we think is a good mix, more grilling stuff in the summer, more crockpot stuff in the winter, stuff like that. But in a given month, we might have like 3 pounds of pork chops, 1 pound of breakfast sausage, 1 pound of Italian sausage, or maybe 2 pounds of Italian sausage, let's say 2 pounds of ground beef. And then we'll possibly have one kind of chicken cut in there, like chicken breasts, and then like a whole chicken, and then a pound of bacon. So that's kind of a typical month for that size share. It'd be around about 16 pounds total. We might change the kind of sausage, and those pork chops might be steaks, or they might be duck breasts or something different one month or another. But generally speaking, that's sort of a template, and then we'll shift off from there and sub things in and out.
So the CSA, do you feel like it offers you more stability as a grower? Do you feel like you would struggle if you wouldn't have put this model in place early on?
So, I mean, right now it's more than half of our revenue for sure. So we definitely would struggle if we didn't have it right now, and we would have to have put in something that really works for meet our customers where they're at and keeping them connected and engaged and wanting to continue. Yeah, our farm wouldn't be what it is without the CSA program. And, you know, we could have structured it differently, but yeah, it's definitely working, and we're trying to continue to make it work better for us and our customers.
Customer retention. Could those customers come from your original vegetable customer base and it kind of grew organically? Or did you find a marketing method, something that really worked and struck for you?
I think there's been a few different ways we've grown over the time. Our vegetable CSA probably never grew more than 25 or 30 people. And we definitely had people who have been with us ever since. We have friends who are friends when we were in our 20s who are still buying CSAs from us today. And yeah, it's really great. And we're thankful for that. And, you know, other people come and go for sure too, you know, leaving town or I don't know, trying out vegetarianism or different reasons things don't work. But one of the ways we definitely grew was Instagram. I don't really know anything about how to use Instagram now. I don't know what reels are. But at some point 10 years ago, we started an Instagram account and kind of got a following of a few thousand folks who like what we do, like what we're sharing, and we were being consistent with it. And I guess that's what the rules were back then to feed the algorithm, was just like be consistent and genuine. And local people followed us and got connected with what we were doing pretty quickly. That's probably where we got our first big wave was from kind of Instagram and being consistent, being people who are present, going to events in town, being at the farmers market, marketing at the farmers market. That kind of got us to where we had about 50 or 60 CSA customers. And then pandemic began. All of a sudden, the grocery store was scary. They had germs and they didn't have any meat. So people kind of freaked out and were really seeking out farmers in a way they never had before. And so we had 200 customers within 3 months who are in our CSA program. We were kind of running out of meat, and we started saying, okay, now if you want to buy meat from us, you got to commit to 6 months. Like, we basically have nothing for you unless you want to join this program. And so we kind of turned that panic buying into, hey, become a part of this program. And people were really excited about it. It went from, oh, I have to commit for 6 months to, oh, wow, he's going to feed me for the next 6 months. That's pretty sweet. So and a lot of people were really thankful that we kind of helped them get through that and helped them feel safe and secure. And their meat showed up on their doorstep. And we were kind of already set up to do that. We just went from doing 7 to 70 deliveries every month, basically. And so, you know, we've kind of come down from that peak. And that makes sense. But yeah, now we're at a phase where we're kind of in the 140, 150 range and trying to kind of keep to that level and then, you know, trying to get back into restaurants. But we really pivoted a whole bunch of meat from restaurants to CSA base. And that worked really fine. We were set up well to pivot. The stuff was packaged in a way that worked for that. And as a small business, you can sometimes pivot easier than more large ships can.
So what would you say the post-pandemic customer retention has been like?
Yeah, I mean, so how many of the pandemic customers have we retained? Is that the question?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I would say we probably made people who we got to sign up for a CSA share during the pandemic, I'd say we retained over half of them. And then we've kind of, you know, as far as like that first big flush. So let's say we grew by 150 people in that 3-month period. We've kept half of those, and the half we've lost, we've replaced them with someone else. So we're somewhere in the range of having maintained numbers somewhere in the 75% of our peak in the post pandemic timeframe, and we'll see how that goes. Summer's always kind of been a slow time for us for kind of selling meat to folks who live and cook at home. It's just like, oh, I'm on vacation. We'll get this done when life is less vacation and kids camp and stuff like that. So right now we're just kind of doing what we can in the summer as we sort of try to not take on too much water.
Yeah. So this is kind of just sort of a question to speak encouragement to the audience, but a USDA census report from 2016 said only 2% of farmers make it past year number 5. And it was interesting to listen to your story. Year number 5 was kind of a breaking point for you in that you pushed past it and became profitable. But can you relate to that and maybe give encouragement to people to push past burnout?
You know, I know a lot of folks who have had that 2 to 4 to 5 year journey and decided it wasn't for them. I think I would say that if you put it in and you kind of figured out that you don't love it, that you don't have to do it. Quitting is for people who want to win at something else. If you just love this lifestyle, if you've tried it and it's great, but you know, some aspect of the marketing or the financial pieces, or just, you know, finding land access. I mean, you kind of when you're coming up to a bottleneck, I mean, get in the habit of figuring out how to make your way through it and past it and smash it. There are solutions, and it's a great time to be getting into this line of work. People want high quality food from someone they can shake the hand of and trust. And it's a really big, it's a growing sector. There's new threats with things like greenwashing and regulation and stuff like that, but they're not necessarily going to be insurmountable or more insurmountable than any other threat to anything else. So I think it's a great time to be in this business, and I love it. And I kind of get a twinkle in my eye when there's a problem to solve. I don't think farming is for you if you don't have at least a little bit of that in you. And as I get older, I kind of like systems that work more than I used to. But I think if you got some energy and you want to build something, it's a great thing to put your mind to. And I can wholeheartedly say that I'm glad I did it.
One final question would be, how important would you say it is for small farmers to be on the internet? You mentioned that was kind of a real boost for you. Do you have a website? Do you have other faces on the internet? And how important is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think in our context here in the United States, yeah, I think it's really, really important. We got a pretty big following on Instagram. I mean, I don't know what anybody thinks of as being a big following, but we might have like 5,000 people follow us on there and a couple thousand on Facebook. And it's great to know we can reach those people and kind of, you know, make them. I kind of think about it as we're providing continued access to know, like, transparency to our current customer base and sort of, you know, just providing a story to some people who want the story. And some of those people who are just kind of there for the story, you know, maybe it'll take them a pandemic or something happening in their lives where they'll go from I'm here for the story to I'd also like to feed my family this meat. But I think that those are really valuable tools, but not as important, I think, as, you know, just having a website where you can actually sell your product and people can find you, one that looks good and just well thought out design where people can flow through. And there's essentially a story being told that involves them, how they can see connecting with you and your product as being a way of meeting their own goals, and, you know, pictures and words and the flow of the pages can tell that. And then you just want to be able to have a really easy path for them to put their money into your bank account when they do decide that that's the thing that they want to do.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we're in a time and place where people are Googling groceries.
Yeah. I mean, it's exploded. It was a trend that was already set to kind of grow steadily. And it just kind of, I think it just got us 3 years faster down the road, 5 years faster down the road than we thought we were going to get.
For more content surrounding small-scale regenerative farming for profit, please visit www.harmonyfarms.blog and be sure to subscribe to my newsletter there.